Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with David Herriot. David was a navigator in the RAF flying the Buccaneer and Tornado GR1. He chats about what it was like to operate the Buccaneer, both over land and sea, as well as his time at Red Flag. As well as flying, he also talks about books, flying a desk, and also gives a personal side. So please go and check out our website to sign up to our newsletter for exclusive footage and updates at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, if you like what we do, please help us by becoming a patron. This helps us to keep putting out quality content on a regular basis and also allows the listener and the viewer to become part of the AI team. Thank you and enjoy. So David, how did you become interested in aviation?
I was a young lad living in Glasgow. My parents had friends in London, and I was invited to London for the Easter holidays. I was 13 at the time. My parents were worried as to how they could get a 13-year-old from Glasgow to London. And then they came up with the brilliant idea of flying me from Glasgow Renfrew Airport to London Heathrow in a Vanguard, British European Airways. And that was my first experience of flying. And when I when the aircraft took off from Renfrew and I looked out the window and felt the sensation of flying, I knew that that was the career for me.
What year did you join the RAF?
I joined the RAF on the 2nd of January 1969 at RAF Church Fenton, not far from where we are today, near Tadcaster, near York. And that was then where they had the Air Crew Officer Training School.
Did you always know you wanted to join the RAF?
Well, certainly after I flew in the Vanguard with British European Airways, I certainly knew I wanted to fly. I was a cadet in the Army CCF at school in Glasgow. So putting the two together, military and aviation, Air Force seemed like the logical conclusion.
What was the process like before you started flying?
For me, it was a little bit awkward. I wasn't the greatest academic in the world at the High School of Glasgow. My headmaster was less than confident that I'd make the grade for a career in the RAF. And so I attended the Officers and Aircrew Selection Centre on a number of occasions, I think three eventually, before I managed to convince the Air Force selectors that I should be given a commission in the Royal Air Force and allowed the opportunity to fly. My application was successful for a commissioning, but it was unsuccessful to be a pilot. Apparently didn't have the aptitude to be a good pilot, so they said I'd make an excellent navigator, and wanting to fly, I jumped at the opportunity.
What was your first ever flying experience?
My first ever flying experience was in the it was a flight from London, from Glasgow to London and return. But I also had a friend at school who joined the Air Force about the same time as me. He eventually became a Phantom pilot, but he had a private pilot's license, and he flew me a couple of times in a thing called a Balco Junior, out over the River Clyde and over Loch Lomond and back to Renfrew Airport. So that was my first experience of real flying, as opposed to being a passenger in an airline.
Was it just how you thought it would be?
Joining the Air Force or flying, yeah. Yes, I think it was just as I thought it would be. The navigational training course at RAF Gaydon, where I started out and finished at RAF Finningley, was fairly intense. And you couldn't make too many errors and expect to get away with it. It was an intense training course. But thankfully, I made the grade and I got to fly the aircraft of my dreams.
What was your first aircraft you were assigned to?
First aircraft I was assigned to after nav school was the Buccaneer.
Can you tell us what it was like to be assigned to this aircraft?
The Air Force had a system at the nav school where the allocated cockpits that were available. At the time when I went through nav school, there were opportunities to fly on the Vulcan, the Victor, the Canberra, the Phantom, and the Buccaneer. It was well known at nav school that the top of the course got, if available, their top choice, their first choice. And those who didn't do quite so well on the training course normally ended up on the V-Force in the early 1970s. I had been up to Scampton as part of the course and looked in the back of a Vulcan and seen the black hole with no ejection seats for the crew. So when I got back from the visit to Scampton, I thought, you're going to have to work harder, Harriet. And so I put my nose to the grindstone and ended up coming third on the course, if I recall correctly. The guy who came top wanted to go back to Bryce Norton, where he'd been an air traffic controller. So he had asked for Britannias, and he got Britannias. The next guy who came second had asked for Phantoms, and he got Phantoms. And I had put down on my dream sheet Buccaneers, and lo and behold, there just happened to be one Buccaneer slot available at the time, and so I was the first RAF student navigator, student out of nav school, to be trained by the RAF as opposed to the Navy on the Buccaneer.
So what was your first experience climbing to the back seat of the Buccaneer?
Well, on the operational conversion unit at RAF Honington, we had to complete 10 simulator sorties, I think, if I remember right, the figure was 10, and fairly intensive ground school of 2 weeks before we actually flew the airplane. So when I climbed into the cockpit for real for the first time, I was quite familiar with my surroundings. What I wasn't quite so prepared for was the experience getting airborne in an aircraft with two Spey engines that were each chucking out just over 11,000 pounds of thrust. So the sensation of accelerating down the runway and getting airborne was a bit more exhilarating than stepping into the cockpit for the first time, having seen it all in the simulator.
David chats about his role on the Buccaneer.
Okay, my role in the Buccaneer was basically to navigate and organize the weapon system. To do that, I'd got a Blue Jacket radar, which I've got here on my left-hand side by my knee, and a joystick to control what I see on the screen beside on my right-hand side here. On my right-hand side, I had a Blue Jacket Doppler navigational system, which gave me either a grid position, if we were doing grid navigation, or a latitude and longitude, which was the normal operations for my preference. Grid was used by the Navy for operating over the sea from the carrier, but generally speaking in the RAF we used lat and long. So the role was to navigate the aircraft from A to B to C to D, find the target, attack the target, and navigate back home. All the weapon system control panels are here, and the bomb distributor was down on my left-hand side. So it's a fairly cluttered cockpit. There's not a great deal of room, as I think you pointed out earlier on, but it was comfortable enough. And the greatest thing about the back seat of the Buccaneer was that when it was designed by Blackburns back in the 50s, because it first flew in 1958, when it was designed by Blackburns, they had the bright idea of offsetting the two ejection seats. So if you look very carefully, the pilot's ejection seat is offset very slightly to the left, and the navigator's ejection seat, my seat, is very slightly to the right, which means as I sit here now, I can see fully forward. And that was a huge boon for navigators because it allowed them, particularly in the maritime game, you could see the ships coming as you ran towards them to attack them. But more importantly, you could see some of the very essential instruments on the right-hand side of the pilot's cockpit, such that if there were any emergencies, you had a pretty good idea of what was going on right from the start. Critical were the two blow gauges, because the Buccaneer was designed with boundary layer control, which meant that air was bled from the engines and was blown across the wing surfaces to give it better lift and more stability when it was approaching the landing on a carrier. And if they failed, it could be catastrophic. So the navigator was able to see instantly if there was a pressure drop in the gauges at critical stages of flight, i.e. landing. So that was the role of the Buccaneer navigator, whether it was maritime or overland. I did both, getting the aircraft to the target, managing the weapon system, releasing the weapons on making sure that the switches were set up properly so that the pilot almost invariably released the weapons on the target, and hopefully accurately too, and then getting us back to base safely.
Could you tell us what a normal sortie was in the Buccaneer?
Well, it depends whether you're talking overland or oversea. Operating out of Larbruck in Germany, which was my first and last tour on the Buccaneer. I did four tours on the Buccaneer. But operating overland out of Larbruck in Germany with targets for war, Warsaw Pact targets east of the inner German border, sortie length would be anything from an hour and a half to an hour 45 minutes. We didn't do air-to-air refueling because the purpose of our positioning in Germany, and when you consider the defences that the Warsaw Pact presented to the east of the inner German border, only a fool would have gone at high level. So we always went low level across the inner German border. That was the plan. We never did it for real, thankfully. But the plan was to go low level to and from the target. So the Buccaneer, with four bombs in the bomb bay, two underwing tanks on the wing, other either electronic countermeasures or weapons on the outerboard planes, the maximum sortie length at low level would be about an hour and a half, an hour 40. So that was over land without air-to-air refueling. If you went in the maritime game with air-to-air refueling, you can go for almost as long as you like. There was a limitation on the gearbox oil. It would run out after about 8 hours, I think. But generally speaking, operating out of Honington in the anti-surface warfare game, attacking ships, let's say, off the Shetlands or in the Norwegian Sea, anything from 2.5 to 3 hour sortie. And if you did air-to-air refueling out of Honington, you might land back at Lossiemouth afterwards, refuel, do another sortie similarly, and then back to Honington. So yeah, a sortie length, maritime game, generally speaking, 2.5 hours.
We get to hear what it was like to operate the Buccaneer at Red Flag.
I'm one of those unfortunate Royal Air Force officers. Despite my 38 years in the RAF, I never actually flew into combat. That's not to say that there weren't wars taking place, but I think you could say I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Certainly on the Buccaneer, when the Falklands were invaded, I was in Germany and wasn't involved. Not that the Buccaneer would have been involved in that anyway. When other fracas took place, I was not involved. And again, when I eventually flew the Tornado, I was about to go to Bahrain to form part of the first aircraft to deploy there after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. But I was posted to the Ministry of Defence at the 11th hour to take over from my boss, who had in the Ministry of Defence, who had already departed for the Gulf to fill in an ops planning appointment. So I never actually went into combat in the cockpit. But I have taken part in a significant number of red flags and maple flags. Red flag at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, and maple flag at Cold Lake Air Force Base in Alberta, Canada. I did two Buccaneer red flags, two Buccaneer maple flags, and two Tornado red flags. So fair experience. And the purpose of those exercises was to introduce aircrew to the first 10 missions of a war. The Americans had discovered during the Vietnam War that they were losing most of their aircrew in the first 10 sorties. So they set up Red Flag to give those aircrew, or those aircrew who followed on, their first 10 missions in a benign but aggressive environment, where they would learn the tricks of the trade, if you like, and hopefully increase their survivability when they went to war. I went on the second RAF participation in Red Flag in 1978, and it was certainly an eye-opener. We were flying at 100 feet and below, although the below is probably not legal, so scratch that from the record. But we flew at 100 feet, about 580 knots. We even flew with live 1,000-pound bombs to attack targets in the Nevada ranges, controlled by Red Flag, and all the time being intercepted by, in the early days, F-5 aggressor aircraft, and latterly F-16s and F-15s. Although there have been occasions when I've been chased by F-102s and F-106s of the American National Guard, who rather pleasingly got a severe telling off afterwards for breaking the sound barrier as they tried to catch Buccaneers at low level. Because when the Buccaneer first went to Red Flag, the Americans had never heard of it, they'd let alone seen it. We had American Exchange aircrew on the Buccaneer force, but they were, given the size of the USAF and the US Navy, they were a very, very, very small percentage. So not many people had heard of the Buccaneer. But they very soon realized the capability and the potential of the aircraft, which could fly so low and so fast and deliver its ordnance and survive, because very few fighters managed to get a kill on the Buccaneer, on Red Flag, that we became the target of choice for the fighters if there were Buccaneers taking part. And the aim of the game for the Red Force aggressors was to get to the debrief and be able to say proudly, "I got a Buccaneer." But very few did, if any.
David chats about becoming a QWI.
I became a QWI because, for a number of reasons, I enjoyed my work in the back seat of the aircraft. I enjoyed weaponry, had an interest in it, and had a very good friend who had done the first QWI course that the Buccaneer Force organised, and he was on the squadron, 12 Squadron, with me at the time, and he recommended me to the chain of command as to be the nominee for the squadron's navigator on the next course. So that's how I got onto the course. The course itself was 4 months long, summer of 1977, and it was fairly intense. When I say fairly intense, the staff took no prisoners. We would start the day about 6:30 in the morning. We would brief a sortie. Four aircraft would get airborne. The number two was always the staff crew, and one crew would lead it. One student crew would lead it, with the other two student crews flying on the wing. We would do various operational type activities, culminating in weapons delivery on the range. We would also do academic weaponry. That's where you just go to the range and drop bombs in the pattern one after another to prove you, to prove the system that you could deliver bombs accurately. So I say the day started quite early in the morning. We'd fly the mission, we'd come back, there'd be a lengthy debrief where if you've ever been nitpicked in your life, you've never been nitpicked unless you've been on the Buccaneer QWI course, because nitpicking was the name of the game. And anything that you did that was remotely out of the normal pattern of events would be picked up at a debrief. Then the next day's lead crew, with the help of the other crews, would start preparing for the next morning's mission. And so your day would start at 6 o'clock in the morning, and invariably it would finish at 9 o'clock at night. We had no overhead projectors. Everything was done on a chalkboard. The briefing, the circuit patterns, every detail of the mission was done on a chalkboard. If you made one mistake on the chalkboard, just by extending a line too far or misspelling a word, then you had to rub it out and start again. When I say rub it out and start again, you had to clean the board back to its basics, wash it, dry it, and then start again. So you couldn't just rub a word out and rewrite it. It had to be absolutely perfect, because the quality that was required of you was to the very highest standard. It was hard work, but we achieved it, and my pilot and I were successful, and I went back to 12 Squadron. I thoroughly enjoyed the course, and when I eventually got to the OCU, on the staff at the OCU, I was selected to be the staff navigator to run the QWI course, and that was how I got to Red Flag in the first instance, because we took the QWI course, a staff crew, three student crews, to America, to Red Flag, in 1978, and that was my first experience of Red Flag as an instructor on the QWI course.
Here we hear how many hours he has on the Buccaneer.
I had my total Buccaneer hours are just over 2,200, if I remember correctly. And I do remember it was the figure was of that rough order of magnitude. But my total flying hours are over 3,000. And I do remember that up until 2008, my total flying hours were 3,000, a couple of hundred, and 50 minutes. And then in 2008, as secretary of the Buccaneer Aircrew Association, I organized a reunion with the South African Air Force Buccaneer Aircrew in Pretoria. 120 odd Brits went down to South Africa and joined up with our fellows who are members of the Buccaneer Aircrew Association in South Africa for a reunion, and I was in South Africa for the best part of 3 weeks because I'd organised it, so I had a fair number of things to... I had to participate in everything effectively. But one of the things that we did participate in was a trip to Thunder City in Cape Town. At Cape Town International Airport, and on our way there, we were informed that one of us would get to fly in the back seat of one of Thunder City's Buccaneers. We were going there for a beer, actually, but they decided that because we were, in their words, real Buccaneer aircrew, they wanted to fly one of us out of a gesture of goodwill. Well, to cut a very long story short, I was the one that was whose name came out of the hat. But my name came out of the hat because it was only my name that was in the hat. It transpired because my mates had all put my name in appreciation of the effort I'd put in to get them to and around South Africa. So I flew 10 minutes around Cape Town International Airport, two beat-ups of the airfield at 500 knots and about 100 feet, with a chap called Ian Pringle, one of the pilots and owners of the Buccaneer at Thunder City. And that 10 minutes extra in a Buccaneer brought my 3,000 and however many hundreds of hours and 50 minutes, up to 3,000 and so many hundreds of hours exactly. So I was very pleased to have. 25 years it had been since I'd climbed out of a Buccaneer cockpit when I climbed into the one at Thunder City, and it was like putting on an old shoe. It smelt as it had done when I'd first climbed into it. It looked like it did when I first climbed into it, and it was so familiar. It was just a sensational experience. 10 minutes, but a very worthwhile 10 minutes.
David gives some nice stories of his time on the Buccaneer.
Okay, most memorable moments in the Buccaneer. They were probably all memorable moments in my Buccaneer career. One sortie particularly springs to mind was we were operating out of Skrydstrup in Germany, and we were bombing on Roma Range, and it was March. So it was, funnily enough, it's March now, but it was March 1970, probably 40 years ago, gracious me. And as we came round, we were doing lay-down bombing, and so we were at 500 knots, 200 feet, when running in towards the target, when we hit a bunch of seagulls, and these were not small seagulls, they were huge seagulls. And the first thing that I was aware of was the bang, obviously, and I tried to speak to the pilot, but got no reply. All this is happening in nanoseconds. Got no reply from the pilot. There was blood smeared over the front windscreen. And so I realized that it was going to be, this could be the first time I'd actually have to use a Martin Baker letdown, as we call it. And the aircraft started to pitch, and it started to roll. And as it was approaching about 90 degrees starboard roll, I thought, now's the time to get out, David. And I was just about to pull the handle when the voice in the front seat said, it's all right, David. Dave, I've got control. The aircraft was shaking like an absolute demon. But it was still flying, and the Buccaneer's a pretty robust aircraft. It was still flying, so we headed back to Skrydstrup, called an emergency on the radio, and landed at Skrydstrup. When we got back to Skrydstrup, it was self-evident that the aircraft had been peppered by seagulls. The smell in the cockpit of burnt chicken was horrendous, but more importantly, the whole nose cone of the aircraft had been shattered and sheared off, such that the control and release computer, which is the mechanism that controls the weapon system, which is just in front of the pilot's feet but behind a bulkhead, the other side of a bulkhead, was visible to the eye. So the whole front of the aircraft had gone. But other than that, it was fine. We were fine. And we climbed out successfully and happily. So that's probably one of my more memorable moments in a Buccaneer. But there are far too many. 2,200 hours in a Buccaneer. I could reel off plenty. Thinking of them is the problem. When you're caught cold by Mike Young. Red flag sorties. Maybe the Queen's Jubilee. When we Queen's Jubilee in 1977, when we were tasked to attack the US convoy that was coming across to participate in the Spithead Review, after we'd attacked them, captain of the ship asked if we could do a beat up along of the fleet. And so I was in the lead aircraft with my pilot, and we had five other Buccaneers, which we put into line astern behind us. The target that we'd picked out of the fleet was the USS California, which was a nuclear-powered cruiser. Its forecastle, the front of deck below the bridge, was completely flat. There were no obstructions on it from at all, from what I can remember. And so rather than fly along the side of the ship, which we would have normally done on a beat-up, we decided to fly from right to left as the ship was ploughing through the waves in the southwest approaches south of Ireland. So we pushed the throttles up 580 knots, got it right down on the deck, and as we flew across the deck, I have this vivid memory of looking up at about 15 degrees into the bridge and seeing the captain looking down at me. Thankfully, he enjoyed it. No signal went back to our base at Honington, and no bollocking was received subsequently. But we had great fun flying the Buccaneer. Marvellous aircraft. Love it.
He chats about switching from the Buccaneer to the Tornado GR1.
Well, I came on to Tornado because at the end of my four tours on Buccaneers, the Air Force thought it was a good idea if I had a year or two off flying. So I was tasked with writing a 600-page secret manual for the Air Force, which was entitled the Conventional Weapons Employment Manual. I had the qualifications to do so. It was a two-year task, and the promise was that once I'd completed it, I would go to Tornado. So I set about it. It took me 15 months to write it and publish it. Don't go looking for it on Amazon, it's not there. It's secret. It's probably well out of date now. But once that was completed, I moved on to Tornado. And I did my training at Cottesmore on Triple T, Tri-National Tornado Training Establishment, in 1985. Then to Honington for the Tornado Weapons Conversion Unit. At the same time, I transferred my qualified weapons instructor ticket from Buccaneer to Tornado, and then was posted out to 17 Squadron at Bruggen in Germany. Having come from the two-seat fast jet environment, the training was nothing that I hadn't anticipated, and I was very comfortable with the fast jet operations. The difference was the avionics and the navigational system was far superior to that of the Buccaneer. We'd moved from basic avionics to digital avionics, and that was really the only difference between the Buccaneer and the Tornado. In terms of capability, the Tornado couldn't go quite as far as the Buccaneer. It could go faster in the Buccaneer, but not with a warload, because it didn't have a bomb bay. So although I've been up to 600 knots in a Tornado on red flag, that was after the target when the weapons had gone. So yeah, it wasn't too much different flying the Tornado, learning to fly the Tornado, having flown the Buccaneer previously. Other people who'd come from the Vulcan Force did find the two-seat operation a little bit of a test, but they all succeeded in the long run.
So was your role the same in the GR1 as it was in the Buccaneer?
Yeah, my role in the GR1 was exactly the same as it was in the Buccaneer. Navigate to the target, deliver the weapons on the target, navigate back from the target, and survive. And of course, in a two-man aircraft, whether it was the Buccaneer or the Tornado, survivability was one of the most important things in a hostile environment. So you had to have your eyes out of the cockpit, and we flew formations to ensure that we had good cross cover, and we could see virtually through a 360-degree bubble around the aircraft, and to make sure that, as well as using the electronic equipment that we had to detect attacking aircraft or surface-to-air missiles or anti-aircraft guns, normal air defense type stuff. But the most important thing was being able to swivel your neck, look behind, and make sure that your tail was clear.
How different was it as a weapon system?
Well, as I've just said a moment ago, the Tornado was much more sophisticated. We've gone from analog in the Buccaneer to digital in the Tornado, and so the weapon system was much more capable of compensating for pilot-induced errors. That's not a slight at pilots, but there are pilot-induced errors, crew-induced errors, but the computer and system in the Tornado was much more capable than the Buccaneer in damping those errors out and making the system far more accurate in weapons delivery terms. And of course, when I was flying the Buccaneer, the weapons that were available to us were 1,000-pound bombs, either free-fall or drag retard, Martel missiles, rockets. But by the time the Tornado came along, although we had 1,000-pound bombs, we were beginning to get things like laser-guided bombs. And now, of course, they've got things like Storm Shadow and Brimstone, which are highly accurate and very effective, which takes away a lot of the need for accuracy from the crew, and but it also at the same time increases their survivability because they don't have to fly over the target to release their weapons.
First time going supersonic.
First time I went supersonic was not in a Buccaneer. The Buccaneer, you would not get a Buccaneer supersonic. Not in a Tornado. But in F-104 Starfighter of the Danish Air Force, when I was on Buccaneers at the time, we were on exercise in Aalborg in Germany, and the local air defense squadron there invited us to fly with them, and I was very lucky to fly in a two-seat F-104 Starfighter, Danish Air Force, and we went supersonic.
What squadrons were you based with in the GR1?
On the Tornado, I was based on 17 Squadron at RAF Bruggen in Germany. Excuse me. I was there for not a great, 18 months, I think, probably, nearly 2 years. Before I was promoted to squadron leader, and I moved from the squadron, again, using my weapons qualification, to become the standards and evaluation weapons officer on the wing at Bruggen, responsible for the weapons training, both conventional and nuclear, of the four squadrons that were at Bruggen at the time.
Do you have any memorable moments while flying the Tornado GR1?
He's at it again. More memorable moments questions. Memorable moments in the GR1. No, that's a lie. I think probably red flag in a Tornado was pretty exhilarating, but I don't even have 1,000 hours on the Tornado, so it's not as it doesn't sit in my memory quite as well as the Buccaneer does.
This might be a silly question then, but out of both of them, which is your favourite?
It is a silly question. The Buccaneer is my favourite by far. I say that not because I've got more hours on the Buccaneer than on the Tornado. I found the Buccaneer to be a man's aircraft. It sits beautifully at low level. It flies at an incredibly good, sustainable, fast speed. It carries a considerable weapon load. And for the guy in the back seat, you have to work at it to do your job properly. Whereas in the Tornado, it doesn't sit quite so comfortably at low level. It does go as fast, it doesn't go as far. It can carry the same number of weapons, but the system works for you, as opposed to you having to work the system for yourself. So I like the Buccaneer. If I go further than that, I love the Buccaneer.
Here, David chats about his post-flying career.
Yeah, when my flying ended in the Air Force in 1990. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait in the summer of that year, and I was as Stanibal Weapons. I was invited by the station commander at Bruggen to select 12 crews to the first 12 crews to deploy to Bahrain. Before the war, or before the British participation in the war in Kuwait. So I put myself down as the 12th navigator in the group, and trained them and myself up in things that we didn't normally do in Germany, like air-to-air refueling. But as I think I said, may have said earlier, I was then posted at the 11th hour to the Minister of Defence in London. That tour in the Ministry of Defence was a training tour in a training desk, looking after all fast jet training across the RAF. It only lasted a year because I was then selected for Staff College. When I came out of Staff College, after a short time at Boscombe Down, I was promoted again, this time to Wing Commander, and I moved into a weapons office in London, responsible for writing and producing operational requirements for air-to-surface weapons for the three services, but the RAF in particular. In that period, I had a number of particularly difficult projects to manage, but fortunately we got through all the scrutiny thrown at us, and today we have the product of those years in MOD in the form of Brimstone and Storm Shadow operating effectively today. After the end of that tour, I realized that my advancing years were going to limit how far I would get in the Air Force, and so I opted to go to the RAF College at Cranwell, where I had the most wonderful tour for 3 years in the Department of Initial Officer Training, introducing new young officers into the Air Force and setting the standards for them and training them on a 24-week course at the RAF College. After that, the Air Force asked me to lead a project that would introduce some air warfare training across the RAF. And with that complete, I retired, on my 58th birthday in 2007.
Here we get a more personal side to David.
So this is a bit more of a personal side. Do you have any hobbies?
Hobbies? Yes. I play golf badly. I've got a chocolate Labrador that I walk, takes up a lot of my time. I'm a genealogist, having researched my family history back to the 1600s. And I've written a number of books or short stories or magazine articles. So yes, I keep myself fairly busy. For my sins, or for other people's sins actually, I'm a magistrate in Nottingham. So I'm fairly busy, and when they say you're busier when you've retired than you were when you were working, I can support that fact.
Do you have a favourite tipple?
Aye, a good drop of malt will do me fine, thank you very much, if you're offering Michael.
Do you have a favourite aircraft?
That's it. Buccaneer.
Is there any aircraft you wish you could have flown?
Is there any aircraft I wish I could have flown? Yes, there is one. When I was a kid and I'd made my mind up I wanted to join the Air Force, my passion was to fly the Lightning. I wanted to be a Lightning fighter pilot. Who wouldn't? But I was a navigator, so that couldn't happen. I almost got to fly a Lightning when the Buccaneers were grounded once. We had problems with fatigue failure in the wings of the Buccaneer, and they were grounded for a period of time, twice in my time on the Buccaneer. And on the second one, a lengthy grounding, we were asked what we would like to do whilst the aircraft were grounded. I said I'd like to go to Binbrook. I said I'd like to participate in life at Binbrook and have the opportunity to fly in the right-hand seat of Lightnings. It was all approved. I was getting ready to go to Binbrook when I was rung up by staff at Binbrook, who told me that if I anticipated flying in the Lightning, I was completely wrong. I was going to do desk work for 6 months. So I declined. But yes, I wouldn't have minded having a trip in a Lightning once or twice.
Do you ever get to any air shows?
It's a bit like a busman's holiday, I think, or for air crew to go to air shows. Having spent my life going to air shows as not part of the crowd, I tend to shy away from them these days. I've got four grandsons, so I can. They're all pretty young at present, but I can anticipate that they will be wanting to go to air shows in the future with Grandad, and Grandad be trawled from cockpit to cockpit explaining one switch after another. So I don't tend to go to air shows these days, but I can see definitely that I will be in the future.
And finally, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
No pilot, no navigator ever gets sick about talking about aviation. It's what we did with our lives. It's become part of us. And what better subject to talk about than aviation and aircraft and what it's like to fly them?
And David chats about the books he's involved with.
Okay, well, many, many years ago, when I was a young lad on the squadrons, and I don't think there's a squadron in the Air Force that doesn't sing a song or two when they've been drinking, I decided that it might be a good idea to compile all the songs that we'd written or sung over the years and produce them into a book. I didn't do it for anything other than produce a book for my mates. But I did produce the Buccaneer Songbook in 2008, I think it was. I seem to recall it. It fell on the same date as same year as we celebrated the first flight of the 50th anniversary of the first flight of the Buccaneer, which was 2008, 50 years on from 1958. So it's an anthology of drinking songs. It covers all the songs that we sang on the squadrons, but it covers quite a few others as well. There are a few copies still available. Not that I'm plugging it, but Mike Young has asked me to mention it. The other probably better book is this one here, The Buccaneer Boys by Graham Pitchfork. Well, Graham Pitchfork effectively is the compiler of it because it's a collection of stories by various people who flew the Buccaneer, both in the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force, and the South African Air Force. And I was very privileged when Graham Pitchfork asked me if I would write the story of what it was like to be in the back seat of a Buccaneer. So that's that. Right now, I'm just finished writing a memoir. Primarily, I wrote it for my children and my grandchildren, but I've been encouraged to publish it, so publish it I might, and I guess if that happens, when it happens, details of it will appear on the Aircrew Interview website, but right now the title's a secret.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And if you want to listen to or watch any more of our interviews, visit us at aircrewinterview.tv. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter and become a patron. Thank you.